Welcome to another African Studies podcast, part of the New Books Network consortium of podcasts dedicated to raising the level of public discourse by introducing serious authors to serious audiences. I'm your host, Jim Lance, and today I am pleased to have as my guest George Enzengola Ntalaja, professor of African, African American, and Diaspora Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Past president of the African Studies Association of the United States and of the African Association of Political Science, Professor Enzengola is the author of several books and numerous articles on African politics, development, and conflict issues. I'll just mention a few of his books in English, that he's written in English. These include Revolution and Counter-Revolution in Africa, Nation Building and State Building in Africa. He's also the editor of The Crisis in Zaire, Myths and Realities, and of Conflict in the Horn of Africa, and he's co-editor of The State and Democracy in Africa, and of the Oxford Companion to Politics of the World. His major work, or at least the one that I as a grad student have become most, is most, I as a grad student is am most familiar with, is The Congo from Leopold to Kabila, A People's History, which won the 2004 Best Book Award of the African Politics Conference Group, an organization of U.S.-based political scientists specializing on Africa. We'll be talking about his new biography of Patrice Lumumba, entitled simply Patrice Lumumba, just published by Ohio University Press as part of the Ohio Short Histories of Africa series. As historian David Gibbs observes, Lumumba was a pivotal player in the history of African nationalism, in the same league as Mandela in terms of his influence. Yet, as with so many prominent figures from earlier generations of Africans struggling for liberation, in the U.S. at least, Lumumba seems shrouded in the mists of memories from another time. This is truly unfortunate, because Lumumba confronted issues and challenges that Africans are still encountering, and his life and legacy merit widespread recognition and understanding. George, welcome to the program, and thank you for being willing to be a guest.
My pleasure.
Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and your early feelings about Lumumba and how he came to influence your role as an African and as an Africanist scholar?
Well, I was in high school from 1958 to 1960, the period of the struggle for independence in the Congo. And as one of the few Congolese in secondary education, we were very much interested in politics, followed the news very closely on radio, read the newspapers, and the school I attended was subscribed to most of the newspapers from Kinshasa. Although we were in the Kasai province, far away from Kinshasa, we received these papers. And we read them passionately and engaged in debates about politics. And Lumumba was always the dominant figure among the politicians or the nationalist leaders. So we were very much supporters of Lumumba. So I grew up as an enthusiastic supporter of Lumumba.
And was it true that you were expelled from your secondary school because of your political activity?
Yes, I was in April 1960, 2 months before independence. Students had rioted on the campus of his boarding school, Methodist Presbyterian Secondary School, not too far from Kananga, then called Lulaburg, in the center of the Kasai province. And so I was accused of being one of the so-called ringleaders of the student rebellion and was kicked out of the school.
And how did you ever meet Lumumba yourself?
No, I never met him. Only heard him on the radio.
Uh-huh. And how did you end up traveling across the world and ending up at UNC?
Well, UNC is only the latest chapter in my life.
Right, I know that.
I've been in the United States since 1962. I came here as an exchange student under an organization known as the International Christian Youth Exchange, ICYE, which was an American organization by Protestant churches which came out as a result of World War II, with the commitment of Americans and Germans to reconcile. And so they were exchanging high school students between the ages of 16 and 18 to spend a year, Americans in Germany, Germans here. It grew up to include other Europeans, then to include Japanese, and after the Korean War, it included the Koreans. Then in 1960, with the Congo crisis, the organization decided to add the Congolese. At the beginning, it was a one-way exchange, only Congolese coming to America, but by the late 60s, Americans were going to the Congo, since we now had a number of families that were willing to host American students. So I came here as part of the program, second group. The first group came in 61, and I came in the second group in 62.
From my reading of your book, Lumumba's background as a youth, he didn't really have it, this opportunity or these avenues that you pursued. Could you give us a little bit of the context in which Lumumba grew up as a young man, providing some background to Belgian colonial rule? Yeah. How Africans were treated during Lumumba's youth and early manhood, and how he himself is basically an autodidact, how he taught himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lumumba grew up in a Belgian colonial territory, the Belgian Congo, where the Belgians had no intention of having Congolese access higher education. They were committed to only providing literacy, primarily in African languages, as a matter of fact, in the 50s, if you look at the UNESCO statistics, the Belgian Congo was highly ranked in developing countries for the number of people with literacy. But most of its people were literate in African languages mostly. We had lots of primary schools, but very few secondary. For example, I told you that I was at the Methodist Presbyterian Secondary School. This was only one of two academic secondary schools by Protestants in the entire Congo. A country that is five times the size of France, three times the size of Nigeria. We had only two Protestant academic secondary schools. Others were vocational schools. This is what the Belgians wanted. We had schools for training nurses, training mechanics, training skilled workers in the mines, and so on and so forth. But we did not want people to be prepared for university. And Lumumba grew up during that time, so he went to primary schools, both on the Catholic and Protestant side, never finished because he always got expelled. Even went to try out the school for nursing assistants. He was also kicked out of that school. And so he decided that the best thing was to learn on his own. And so he went out to find a job, became a clerk, went to evening classes provided by the Maris Brothers, a Catholic order. And so he basically is a self-educated person.
You mentioned he was kicked out. Was he kicked out for political activities or other reasons?
Well, he was kicked out mostly because they found him to be a student who did not, who was not very quiet. He was a leader. He kept organizing. He kept contesting the teachers. As a matter of fact, as I explained in my book, we had a situation where people would finish elementary school and then become teachers in the same school simply because they have had some education. And so it happened that Lumumba, because of his ability to acquire books and read and so on, sometimes he knew more French than the teachers were teaching him. And he would correct them when they made mistakes. And so this was considered to be very impolite. And also the fact that he was very enamored of traditional dance and in a very conservative Protestant setting, those were considered to be sinful or backward, and so he was not seen in a good light by the missionaries and the African teachers.
Where did he get the resources or the materials for his self-education?
Well, mostly it was basically finding whatever was available through friends or through Congolese who had gone before him, who were medical assistants or nurses or people working as agricultural teachers. So we had people who had gone to education and who were who had some books, and so any book that Lumumba would find, he would read it. And certainly when he went to Kisangani, he was able to have access to a library. There was a library for the African township in Kisangani. Lumumba volunteered to be a part-time librarian in the evenings and on weekends, and this allowed him to have time to read. So he kept reading everything he could lay his hands on.
What about Lumumba's family? Were they supportive of these endeavors and encouraged him to pursue this track?
Well, in Kasai, where he was born and grew up, his father was, of course, a peasant, and he was committed to having him going to school, but they couldn't really give him that much support in terms of they didn't have the means to do so. In Kisangani, where he was an adult and on his own, I think that, you know, his wife simply tolerated the fact that this man will spend long hours at the library and spend a lot of time during the weekend reading and so on. So that could be considered to be support, I guess.
I guess. Tell us about his early years as a civil servant and what he learned from that experience.
Well, mostly he was a very ambitious person, wanted to get ahead, because during that time, one of the major preoccupations among the lower civil servants, who were all Congolese, was to be treated in the same way as the European civil servants. But again, as you know, there were two separate civil service statuses. There's a status for the Europeans and a different status for the Africans. Europeans were paid much, much better, sometimes 10 or 15 times the amount of money paid to Africans. They had the right to own a car, to have a house, to have, you know, things paid for, and of course, vacation back home every 2 or 3 years for the whole summer or for 6 months. And Africans had to work 12 months, very little vacation, very little pay. And so the main preoccupation was to fight for equal pay, for equal work, and for dignity, for being treated as human beings rather than being insulted as a macaque or monkey, and being discriminated against because of the skin color. And so Lumumba became very active in the associations of these what you may call middle class Africans, those who were at least comparable to what we'll call the middle class today, and rose to become president, vice president, or secretary of several organizations of the elites in Kisangani. And so he started writing. At the beginning, his writing was very much informed by the colonial ideology, in the sense that he was praising the Belgian enterprise in the Congo as a civilizing mission. He thought that the Belgians were out there to help the Congo develop and so on. But he was very much dismayed by the racial discrimination, the racism of the system. And this really put him in conflict with many of his European colleagues in the civil service.
That raises something that I wasn't as fully aware as I should have been from reading your book, and that is that he really wasn't initially opposed to colonial rule per se, but he was opposed to the racism
exactly.
inherent.
Exactly.
So
Mm-hmm.
So he really wasn't, at this point, he really wasn't like a Frantz Fanon or an Nkrumah in terms of his thinking about politics.
Not at all, because he was very much within the colonial ideology of a civilizing mission. And he, in the mid-50s, especially 1955, when the young King Baudouin of the Belgians went to the Congo for the first time, Lumumba had a 10-minute conversation with him at the reception and at the governor's mansion, which surprised a lot of people, both Belgians and the Congolese. And Lumumba was there a great believer in the slogan of the Belgo-Congolese community, that we were that the thing to do was to create a community that would be multiracial, that would involve both Congolese and Belgians. Then in next year, 1956, he was invited to visit Belgium for the whole month, traveled around the country for the whole month. So when he came back, the situation started to change when he was arrested on charges of having embezzled funds at the post office.
Well, this is, you're talking about a theme or something that surprised me constantly throughout the book, and maybe as we progress in our conversation, we can address it.
Mm-hmm.
How Lumumba, who really, to my reading, did not seem, in this context, a terribly threatening figure mm-hmm. to the Belgians and to later on the United States in particular,
yeah.
how he became such a threat. So in your chapter, on what you call Lumumba's years of transition, you chronicle how he became more intensely involved in politics and how he eventually came to surpass other Congolese politicians who at the time were even more radical than he was, such as Joseph Kasavubu.
So, right.
So could you outline how he kind of rose through the ranks politically to become the major figure in Congolese politics at this time?
Yes, I think that his trip to Belgium was very important event because in the Congo, the Belgians did not allow any progressive literature, especially from the communist or socialist perspective, to come into the colony. All of those were banned because they did not want the Congolese to be introduced to these ideas. And I think that when Lumumba went to Belgium and met a number of progressive Belgians, he started looking at the world a little differently. And then when he came back home and was arrested and jailed, you know, as an évolué, Lumumba had rose to acquire both of the distinguishing statuses, I would say, given to Congolese who had become more or less evolved or more educated or higher up. The first was the civic merit card. A civic merit card meaning that you are a person of merit, that you are not similar to ordinary Congolese, that you can be allowed to European cars in the trains, you can be allowed into restaurants, into movie theaters, which are frequented by Europeans, and so on and so forth. Then this was in 1948 that this was introduced, and Lumumba, I think, got his around 1950 or so. Then he later on got the new status of matriculation, known in French as immatriculation. Matriculation meant that you now have the same legal status as a European, so more or less an honorary European. Your children can go to European schools, like Lumumba's children did in Kisangani. You can be tried in a European court rather than in a so-called native court. And you had all the rights, you and your family had all the rights recognized Europeans. But there were contradictions because in spite of this, this did not affect, for example, the wage bar, which remained a color bar. The fact that the civil service continued with these two separate separate branches, the European and the African branch. And Lum, for example, he was earning a salary of 5,000 Belgian francs in 1956. That was the equivalent of $100. And this compared that to the salary he would earn only a few years later when he became the commercial or the publicity director of the brewery in Kinshasa. He was earning 25,000, five times more, and had a car given to him and housing and all that. And so there was a lot of discontent among Congolese because of this wage bar, this difference in wages, and also the fact that discrimination did not disappear. You know that there were still many obstacles to enjoying life as a human being or as an educated person because of your skin color, and so he began to have a lot of different ideas about this. And then, of course, when he was arrested as a person holding the matriculation status, he had the right to bail and to be free until a court makes a decision on his case. He was put in jail. Alvo, of course, as a person of matriculation, he did not have to endure wearing the shorts, khaki of the uniform of the Congolese prisoners. He didn't have to be whipped like Congolese prisoners were whipped. He didn't have to do hard labor as Congolese prisoners. So he had all this time in jail to read. So he read a lot of books. He caught up on things that he hadn't read before, and started thinking about the future. And so by the time he was freed in 1957, he was ready to embark on a new life. And then the Accra meeting in 1958, December 58, changed everything for him.
Right. Well, that leads to the chapter in which you note that everything changed after he went to Accra, mm-hmm. and came back, and that really served as a catalyst for the independence struggle and speeding it up.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about the period 1958 to 60, where Lumumba's star really rose.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you mentioned in the book that I think, and many people, again, it's sort of an example of how historical memory has become foggy and muted. But Lumumba also had many adversaries and opponents within the African community itself.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
So who were some of these major opponents, and how did Lumumba deal with them and deal with opposition, and how did he really become the leading figure again?
Well, at the beginning, the opposition between him and others was not really vicious. It was what you'd expect in any political environment, that people would differ in terms of strategies and tactics and positions on major issues. When he came to Kinshasa, for example, he was brought into the Kinshasa political class by moderates, mostly Catholic intellectuals like Joseph Ileo and Joseph Ngalula, and the person who became the first cardinal in the Congo, the second cardinal in Africa, Joseph Malula. It's interesting, all of them have Joseph as their first name. But anyway, and these people were, for example, on the major issue confronting the Congo in 1956 to 58 was the so-called Van Bilsen Plan. This is a pamphlet written by a Belgian professor at the Colonial University in Antwerp in December 1955 in Flemish, then was translated into French in February 56, entitled A 30-Year Plan for the Political Emancipation of Belgian Africa, meaning the Congo, Rwanda, and Burundi. And this pamphlet became a major defining moment for the Congolese elite as to how fast to go in attaining independence. The Catholic intellectuals mentioned were generally in agreement with the Van Bilsen plan decided that it is a good starting. We may not be completely, we may not embrace it wholeheartedly, but we found it to be a good platform on which to start discussions on the future of the Congo. Joseph Kasavubu, the leader of the Alliance of the Bakongo, Bakongo Ethnic Group, they took a very, very different position. They rejected the Van Bilsen plan as simply useless. They said the Congo needs its independence. And when Kasavubu presented his own counter manifesto in August of 1956, in the public, he used the word independence immediate, immediate independence. And so that became the slogan of the independence struggle for the next 4 years in the Congo. So Lumumba, who was introduced to the Kinshasa political class by the moderates, was actually in much greater sympathy with Kasavubu on the issue of the pace of movement to independence. But he disagreed with Kasavubu on two major issues. Kasavubu wanted a federal system and not a unitary state. Lumumba was for a unitary state, did not want federalism. And secondly, Kasavubu was leading an ethnic party. The Abaco was basically exclusively a group for the Bakongo. And Lumumba wanted a group that, to create a movement that would be open to all Congolese, from all ethnic groups, from all provinces, and so on. So this is the, so these differences went on to become bigger as time went on, because as we approach independence, the moderates were very much closer to American and Belgian positions, and Kasavubu, although he started out as being radical, he moved more and more toward the moderates as independence came.
Well, that brings up, to me, this is the time when Lumumba became most familiar, the African leader most familiar to me, because I did my work in Ghana, in Nkrumah.
Right.
And his famous maxim, seek ye first the political kingdom. It seems, if I read this chapter right, it seems if Lumumba did have an ideological perspective, it was that of a nationalist. He didn't seem to be influenced by Marxist or socialist thinking, and it seems to me you depict him as being relatively indifferent to issues of economy or political economy. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Very much so, in a sense that, to start with, as I pointed out, in the Belgian Congo, we didn't have any socialist or Marxist literature, so Lumumba did not know what Marxism is all about. I mean, what he heard is what the Catholic priest was saying, that, communists are people don't believe in God, and they want a community of goods, and of course, in Africa, the best way to scare people from that, said people want a community of wives. and so that, we heard all these cliche being bandied about concerning communism. So he was not a socialist thinker like Cabral or Fanon or even Nkrumah, but he was with them in terms of fighting for total independence. He wanted Africa to be genuinely independent and not to continue being controlled by Europeans, as many of the Francophone former French colonies became, that they were very much beholden to Paris, and Paris continued to dominate those countries. So Lumumba became different from other leaders in the Congo by becoming closer to people like Nkrumah in terms of fighting for genuine independence. But when it came to economic issues, he didn't pay much attention. These are issues that were not understood by many, even though he worked in a brewery for a year and a half or so. He did not really understand the way the economy was running in the country. They felt that, you know, once we control the political power, we can take care of the economy.
Again, when I read this chapter, I was just I was flabbergasted at how Lumumba came to be seen as a threat. I mean, I think you mentioned the Economic Roundtable Conference,
yes,
in Brussels, where basically Belgian economic interests, mining interests,
exactly,
got exactly what they want. Mm-hmm. Yet throughout the book, Lumumba is seen as a threat. He's branded as a communist,
exactly,
a socialist. And I just, why? And I guess that leads to how he became prime minister, mm-hmm, and how he became excoriated and vilified as this demon.
Well, David Gibbs, person who wrote that blurb and for the book, said in his evaluation of my manuscript for Ohio University Press that he found that chapter 6 was really the best chapter in the whole book. This is a chapter where I'm talking about the counter-revolution in Southern Africa. That is the
reason. Can I ask you about that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, see, most people tend to say that Lumumba was killed because of the Cold War. Well, the Cold War, I argue, was simply the pretext. Because Lumumba was not pro-communist. As a matter of fact, and the Americans and the Belgians, they all knew this very, very well. When the mutiny of the armed forces took place on July 5th, 5 days after independence, who did Lumumba turn to for military support? The United States. Lumumba and President Kasavubu went to the American ambassador and said, we would like the United States to intervene and stop the Belgians from taking over the country again and having the Katanga province secede. The American ambassador told him, no, the U.S. can't intervene because we can't intervene against our NATO ally, Belgium. You better ask support from the United Nations. And so they went to the United Nations. The United Nations came in with a mandate that was clearly in favor of the request of the Lumumba government, which was to help the Lumumba government maintain law and order, to evict the Belgian soldiers from Katanga province and the mercenaries who were helping Chombe secede from the Congo, and to help run essential services. And so these were what the UN mandate was all about. But when it came to the Katanga, the UN Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld, could not really do what Lumumba expected him to do, which was to kick the Belgians out, because he knew that Britain and France were not in support of kicking the Belgians out. And Britain and France were members of the Security Council, and also the allies of Belgium as colonial powers. Dag Hammarskjöld tried to play the game his own way. And he's the one who had been the person drafting the resolution, Security Council, and so on. And Lumumba found that what he was doing was contrary not only to the spirit, but to the letter even of the council resolutions. So going back to the main issue, was that the secession of Katanga was not the work of Congolese. It was primarily the work of white settlers and mining companies supported by right-wing lobbies in the United States and in Britain. As you know, all of Southern Africa, from South Africa to Zambia, was under the control of white settlers. They were in control of Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Malawi under the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. They were in control of South Africa, control of Namibia, they're known as Southwest Africa, control of Angola under Portuguese rule, and control of Mozambique under Portuguese rule. And Katanga had the largest concentration of white settlers in the Congo, who were involved not only in the mining industry, and the associated industries, but also in farming, in ranching especially. And so they were very well settled. And they had, for many years, they've been fighting to gain the same kind of political power as the white settlers in the Rhodesians. But they could not, because the mining companies did not want the settlers to have so much power, because that would reduce the amount of profits they could keep, because they would have to spend a lot on development in Katanga and on social services for the settlers. But now, when Lumumba became prime minister, they saw the threat of a prime minister who would like to control the economy so that the Congolese resources can serve the mass of the people.
And he became prime minister
Lumumba became a threat to them, and this made it possible for the settlers and the mining companies to become allies. You know, they were adversaries during the colonial period, but as the independence approached, they became allies. And the settlers were now claiming to secede from the Congo and make Katanga to be much, much closer associated with Southern Africa. So that is the main issue. And so the European powers, supported by the United States, used the Cold War simply as a pretext, knowing full well Lumumba was not a communist, was not pro-communist. And they just used it because they had to explain to their own constituencies why they were fighting Lumumba and so on. But the main thing was a struggle for the control of the area, and also the fact that an independent Congo under Lumumba's control was likely to play a key role in a fight for liberation in Southern Africa. We didn't want to see that happen.
Right. That was the message, really, what I really came away from your book. And I think Professor Gibbs, I'd say the whole book is wonderful, but that chapter in particular, it really seemed to me that it was the domino theory here. Our fear was nationalism, not communism.
Exactly.
Or economic takeover. And,
exactly.
And I think the second factor was that we're dealing with settler settler colonies, not
exactly.
Well, Ghana didn't have a large
exactly.
settler presence.
Mm-hmm.
So can you outline, define, and kind of just go through with us the events of the Congo crisis that led to you've started, but what led to his assassination and really the horrendous performance by many people,
the U.S.
in particular.
Yeah, the Congo crisis started, of course, with the mutiny of the armed forces. And here again, I point out to the contradiction in Lumumba's own position, the fact that here he was talking for independence to become a new chapter in our lives and to improve the lives of the people, but remained technocratic in his thinking concerning the army. And just like the same way as Nkrumah did, you know, Nkrumah kept British officers in the Ghanaian army from 1957 up to 1961. You know, 4 years, almost all of the general officers, of course there was only a few generals, but and colonels, but the superior officers, high-ranking officers, were all British, very few Ghanaians, because he believed that the Ghanaians needed more time to be trained to become officers. In the Congo, we didn't have any. You know, the Belgian system was that the Congolese, the highest rank could be attained by Congolese was that of sergeant major. It only in 1959, 1 year for independence, some sergeant majors were allowed to train to become warrant officers. So, but again, all of this is non-commissioned officer rank. So we didn't have a single second lieutenant in our army. Not a single Congolese was a second lieutenant. And so the soldiers wanted promotions, and of course better pay. And Lumumba said, well, you know, you guys should have patience. We'll organize training for you. After training, then you become officers. The soldier said, but how about you, Mr. Lumumba, you and your ministers, what kind of training did you have to occupy the position you are occupying, you see? And so this was a major problem. And the commander of the Force Publique, General Janssens, had an excellent intelligence service. He knew about the discontent within the army, and he played on it. He basically instigated the mutiny by calling soldiers to a meeting in Kinshasa on the 4th of July, went before the blackboard, and in which he wrote, "Before independence equals after independence." So he goes like this, said that warrant officers, sergeants, corporals, men, independence is for civilians. You're going to remain under the control of Belgian officers. Discipline will be maintained. No disorder will be allowed. And of course, after that meeting, what happened? Soldiers went straight to the ammunition depots, broke it, opened it, and took over the guns and ammunition and went after the Belgian officers. And they disarmed all of them and unfortunately committed some acts of brutality. That really, and because of how those events were shown in the Belgian press and the sidewalk radio among the Europeans, the rumor mill among the Europeans, Europeans started leaving the country. So we had the exodus of thousands. We had 100,000 Belgians in the Congo at independence. Most of them left the country. So this brought about a major problem in terms of the breakdown in essential services and, of course, in law and order. And so that's why the UN was called upon to come. But then the UN did not act in the way that Lumumba had expected them to act, which his main concern being that they should not allow Belgian troops to be stationed in Katanga to be supporting the secession of Katanga province. And so this is what made Lumumba an enemy to the Belgians, and then, of course, became an enemy to the Americans when the UN refused to help him expel Belgians from Katanga. Lumumba called on the Soviet Union for military support. Soviet Union sent in logistical support, planes, transport planes especially, and planes for bombing, anything like that, just transport planes, trucks, and some technicians to help in logistics. That was seen as real sin by the West, is a major provocation from Lumumba. The CIA was called upon by the President Eisenhower to take action to kill Lumumba. The Belgians also set up a plot to kill him as well. So this is where the whole problem started. And of course, they used the Congolese, especially on the advice of the CIA station master in Kinshasa, Mr. Devlin, who felt that the CIA plot to kill Lumumba by poisoning his food and toothpaste was ludicrous. Felt that it would be very difficult to penetrate the security at Lumumba's residence to do that, and felt that the best strategy was to use his Congolese adversaries to eliminate him politically and eventually physically. And that's exactly what was done, because all of them, as Stephen Weissman has pointed out in his numerous publications, President Kasavubu, a number of the ministers and other people became in the pay of the CIA to be used as individuals who would act against Lumumba, and that's what they did. Kasavubu dismissed Lumumba unjustifiably on September the 5th, and Parliament rejected his decision, but then on September 14, Mobutu staged a coup d'etat with the support of the General Ketani of Morocco, who was the number two commander in the UN force in the Congo. And so this led to Lumumba's being held hostage, being held basically prisoner in his residence under house arrest. until when he tried to run away on November 27, and when he was pursued and caught and then imprisoned until he was assassinated on January 17, 1961.
And he was only about, what, 36 years old, is that?
He was 35.
35.
Yeah, he's born on July 2nd, 1925. So at independence, he was 34. He became 35 2 days after independence, and he died at 35 and a half.
I was reading an article in The Guardian about which claimed that Lumumba's assassination was the most important political assassination of the 20th century.
That was my article.
In fact, that is true.
what I quoted was a Belgian sociologist, Ludo De Wit, who wrote the best book there is on Lumumba's assassination, entitled "The Assassination of Lumumba." That's what he says in his book, mm-hmm. and I was quoting him. Yeah.
Well, that kind of leads to a what if question, and I know that they're sort of silly, but what if Lumumba hadn't been assassinated and his role as prime minister had continued? What do you think the trajectory, how would the trajectory of Congolese history have differed?
Would have been quite different. I would imagine that Lumumba, at the best, he would have become a leader like Julius Nyerere in Tanzania. At worst, he would become Sekou Touré in Guinea, given the dynamics of politics in Africa. But we don't know. No one can really tell what would have happened. That's just my own imagination.
Mm-hmm.
As Jean-Paul Sartre wrote in the introduction to Jean Van Lier's book, The Political Thought of Patrice Lumumba, Jean-Paul Sartre said that Lumumba dead is probably a greater plus for the Congo and Africa than Lumumba life. and that's probably true, because of his death, what he did was he left a great legacy, the legacy of commitment to national unity. That's why it would be very, very difficult for all those people trying to break up the Congo into several states, beginning with Chombe, with the Session of Katanga in 1960, will find it very, very difficult, because the people of the Congo are very, very committed to national unity. The idea of a single Congo is very, very strong among the Congolese. And that's mostly because of Lumumba. And also this commitment that the Congo's resources are to be used for development of its people. And so there is a commitment to national unity, commitment to development, commitment to Pan-Africanism. All of these are part of the heritage of Patrice Lumumba. So I think that he had served a great purpose in terms of the political history of our country.
And those are indeed no small achievements, for as you mentioned, the Congo is 5 times the size of France and 3 times the size of Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And to instill among peoples in a territory so vast a sense of national unity and purpose is truly important. Because when I was in Ghana, the question was, what does it mean to be a Ghanaian? And Ghana is only about the size of Oregon.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
We've been talking with Professor George Nzengola Ntalaja about his book, part of the Ohio University's Short Histories of Africa series. His book, his biography of Patrice Lumumba, simply entitled Patrice Lumumba. It's a very important book. It's a book that anyone can read. It's not for specialists in Africa or people who are experts in African politics. It's a book about a key figure in 20th century global history, and it's one that should be read. Professor Nzengola, I can't thank you enough for being part of the program. I will. It should be up on the New Books Network within a day or two,
okay.
And I hope I can see you at ASA conference and meet you face to face.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Right, my pleasure.